Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Wall Street Journal Business News for Wednesday, June 10th, 2026. And here are today's news headlines. Novelis, top aluminum supplier to Ford, to restart plant after fires. Two fires at the upstate New York facility last year proved extremely disruptive to the auto industry. By Bob Tita. 19 Things to Know About Gwynne Shotwell, SpaceX's President. Elon Musk, trusted lieutenant, has a ritual for lunch days and put a Starlink on the roof of her car. By Celia Bernhardt. Tech, Media, and Telecom Roundup Market Talk. Find insight on SK Hynix's planned U.S. listing and more on the latest Market Talks covering technology, media, and telecom. Now is a good time to buy into America's mega utility merger. The largest U.S. utility is about to buy Dominion Energy, a big peer with data center exposure. What's not to like? By Jinju Lee. Musk looks to an army of loyalists to help him make him a trillionaire. The SpaceX IPO is expected to set records Friday and mark a new pinnacle in Wall Street's retail revolution. By Hannah Aaron Lang and Corey Drybush. Los Angeles stadium workers reach deal to head off World Cup strike. The union said the lowest paid workers at SoFi Stadium would get a big pay raise to $40 an hour. By Paul Kiernan. And here's our first article for the day. Novelis, top aluminum supplier to Ford, to restart plant after fires. Two fires last year proved extremely disruptive to auto industry. By Bob Titla. An aluminum rolling plant in upstate New York that supplies Ford Motor and other automakers will restart production Wednesday, 9 months after a fire caused a supply crisis for the car industry, the plant's owner said. Novelis plant in Oswego, New York, is the largest domestic supplier of aluminum sheet for the U.S. automotive industry. It serves about a dozen companies, including Ford, General Motors, Jeep, and Ram parent Stellantis, as well as foreign automakers with U.S. production facilities. A fire at the plant in September idled the rolling line where aluminum sheet is produced. Another fire in November caused additional damage to the rolling equipment and plant building. The thin aluminum sheets produced at the plant are later stamped into fenders, hoods, and other exterior vehicle parts. The outage was particularly disruptive for Ford, which uses aluminum for the body of the F-150 pickup truck, America's best-selling vehicle for decades. The subsequent shortage of aluminum produced Ford's inventories of trucks at its dealers going into summer, typically a busy time for new auto sales. Novelis said it mobilized its plants in Europe and South Korea to supply U.S. customers during the outage in New York, but the contingencies cost automakers billions of dollars. While this is positive progress, the disruption is a clear reminder of the distress facing many automotive suppliers today, a Ford spokesman said. Ford is committed to finding new and enhanced ways to work with our partners to prioritize long-term supply chain resilience. The U.S.'s 50% tariff on imported aluminum and the war with Iran have driven up the price of aluminum and tightened the global supply of metal. The Middle East is a major aluminum-producing region. Automakers in recent years have increased their use of the lightweight metal. The auto industry in North America consumed 3.7 million metric tons of aluminum last year, nearly 30% more than in 2020, according to metals market consulting firm CRU. Novelis said it expects the Oswego plant to operate at less than full capacity in the coming weeks. We are deeply grateful for the flexibility and partnership of our customers have shown, as well as the extraordinary efforts of our employees, Novellus President Steve Fisher said. Atlanta-based Novellus, a unit of India's Hindalco Industries, is in the process of adding more production capacity for automotive sheet at the new rolling plant under construction in Alabama. The company expects the full plant to be close to starting by the end of the year. Bob Titla covers manufacturing and metals industries from the Wall Street Journal's Chicago Bureau. 19 Things to Know About Gwynne Shotwell, SpaceX's President. Elon Musk's trusted lieutenant has a ritual for launch days and put a Starlink on the roof of her car. By Cecilia Bernhardt. Gwynne Shotwell, one of the first executives hired by Elon Musk at SpaceX, has helped build it into one of the world's most valuable companies. Shotwell is an engineer who has been SpaceX's president since 2008. She has overseen the development of SpaceX's rockets, run its day-to-day operations, and worked alongside Musk for over two decades. Here, culled from interviews, speeches, and published reports, are 19 things to know about her. 1. She's a diplomat. She's seen a steady hand engendering trust in the company from those who have been unsettled by Musk's actions. 2. Shotwell translates Musk's lofty ideas into concrete plans. I've always felt like my job was to take these ideas and turn them into company goals to make them achievable, she said, at a 2018 TED conference. 3. She is a billionaire. After the IPO, Shotwell's net worth will be well north of $1 billion. She owns about 12.6 million shares, according to the IPO filings. 4. Shotwell was paid $86 million last year, mostly in the form of stock options. 5. She's one of 8 board members at SpaceX, a seat she has held since 2009. She's also a director at Polaris, a manufacturer of ATVs and snowmobiles. 6. She is 62 and has worked with Musk for two decades. I've always loved working for Elon, she's told Time magazine earlier this year. He's really quite funny. He gives me the freedom and flexibility to do my job. 7. Shotwell has a specific ritual for launch days, which she describes as nerve-wracking. Because she was in Scotland the first time the company successfully got a rocket into orbit, she now writes Scotland on 2 sticky notes and places each inside her shoes to be in Scotland for every launch, she said in a 2022 talk at Stanford's Business School. 8. Shotwell worked to prevent business fallout in the height of Musk and President Trump's feud in June of 2025. When Musk threatened to decommission a spacecraft that transports cargo and astronauts to the International Space Station, she spoke with NASA officials and assured them the tensions would pass. 9. Shotwell has been a staunch defender of Musk, including after allegations in 2022 that he harassed a flight attendant. She sent out a company-wide email stating that she believed the allegations were false. When some employees posted an internal letter criticizing Musk and the company's response, Shotwell called the letter overreaching activism. The employees were later fired. 10. She doesn't love Musk's social media persona. I like his in-person self better than his Twitter self, Shotwell said at Stanford. In fact, they feel like two different people to me many of the times. 11. She has a much different social media presence than her boss, posting sparingly and exclusively about SpaceX. 12. Shotwell was raised outside Chicago by her father, a brain surgeon, and her mother, an artist. 13. She decided as a teenager that she would become an engineer on the day her mother took her to a Society of Women Engineers conference. 14. Shotwell started her career at Chrysler. After earning her bachelor's in engineering and a master's degree in applied math from Northwestern, I was unsatisfied with the level of technology I was working on there, she said, at Stanford. 15. Her first role at SpaceX was vice president of business development, where she developed connections with satellite executives and government officials across the globe, pitching them on the ideas of the company long before it had concrete success. 16. She was promoted to SpaceX president and chief operating officer in 2008, the same year the company won a critical $1.6 billion NASA cargo transport deal. 17. She would be disappointed if SpaceX didn't have a settlement on the moon and wasn't building a manufacturing facility on the moon within 10 years, she told Time. 18. Shotwell lives in a 1,000-acre ranch close to a SpaceX facility in McGregor, Texas. She's married to a fellow space engineer and has two children from a previous marriage. 19. She put a Starlink mini terminal on the top of her car to speak with Musk on her 40-minute commutes without the call dropping, she said, in a 2024 conference. Celia Bernhardt is a corporate news intern and part of the summer of 2026 newsroom intern class at the Wall Street Journal. Now is a good time to buy into America's mega utility merger. The largest U.S. utility is about to buy Dominion Energy, a big peer with data center exposure. What's not to like? By Jinju Lee. Shares of America's largest utility, NextEra Energy, have fallen about 9% since the company announced last month that it would buy Dominion Energy. This could be a good time to buy the dip on a top-notch utility. NextEra said it would buy Dominion in a mostly stock deal, creating a giant that would be more than double the size by market capitalization of the next biggest utility. Dominion shares were trading at such a discount, about a quarter lower than NextEra's forward earnings multiple, that the latter was able to offer a hefty premium without denting its earnings growth. NextEra expects the deal to be immediately accretive to its earnings per share. There could be a subset of NextEra investors that don't want to be part of Dominion, which has been stuck in the discount bin for the past few years. The latest overhang on the stock was its offshore wind project, which ran into cost overruns and a stop work order by the Trump administration. Regulatory risks are another reason for the decline. Utilities frequently get put into a merger penalty box because of the possibility that regulators will extract ratepayer-friendly concessions from utilities seeking deal approvals, according to Tim Winter, a portfolio manager of utilities funds at Gabelli. So far, NextEra has promised $2.25 billion worth of bill credits for Dominion's customers. But regulators are hyper-focused on affordability these days and might ask for more. That is a real risk, but the rewards of the deal are considerable. NextEra already has two top assets, a well-managed regulated utility in Florida, Power and Light, and NextEra Energy Resources, one of the most prolific power plant developers in North America. The latter is a rare asset because U.S. power demand growth had been stagnant before the AI boom. Many publicly listed utilities haven't built out power plants in a very long time. Dominion has two things that NextEra doesn't. One is exposure to Virginia, a data center-rich territory with high electricity demand growth. Dominion's power demand is expected to grow by 5% to 6% over the next decade on a compound annual growth rate basis, among the highest in the sector. According to analysis from Hugh Wayne, equity analyst at SSR, you get to tie its rapid growth opportunity at Dominion with NextEra's capital and expertise to realize it, Wayne said. Secondly, Dominion comes with a large regulated utility base that would take NextEra's mix of lower-risk regulated utility earnings from around 70% to more than 80%, according to S&P Global Ratings. This is perhaps the more compelling deal rationale. It gives NextEra's rapidly growing unregulated development arm a lot of breathing room to expand without triggering a credit downgrade. NextEra's unregulated arm is the primary way the company can participate in demand growth outside of its own Florida territory, which hasn't been a hotspot for data center growth. And what if the deal doesn't close? This is a reasonable concern given NextEra's poor track record of getting acquisitions over the finish line. Even so, the share price decline has knocked roughly $18 billion off its market value, well above the $4.83 billion termination fee it must pay if regulators block the transaction. NextEra, as a standalone company, is still the nation's biggest utility, with targeted annual earnings per share growth of 8% or more, on the high end of its peer group. And the company's unregulated arm still has plenty of room to grow without triggering credit concerns. NextEra has estimated that it can keep growing earnings in that unit at a heady 12% pace through 2032 while maintaining its credit rating. NextEra's share could be stuck in the penalty box for a while longer with regulatory approvals across Virginia, South Carolina, and North Carolina, expected to take 12 to 18 months. But its prospects don't look any dimmer than they did before the deal news, with or without Dominion. Ginger Lee is a New York-based columnist for Heard on the Street, covering the retail and energy sectors. Musk looks to an army of loyalists to help make him a trillionaire. The SpaceX IPO is expected to set records Friday and mark a new pinnacle in Wall Street's retail revolution. By Hannah Aaron Lang and Corey Drybush. Dean Norrie wants in on the biggest stock market debut of all time. Elon Musk is counting on it. Norrie, a 41-year-old fintech entrepreneur, spent years listening to Musk's video and podcast interviews. Tesla stock makes up some 85% of his net worth, and when shares of SpaceX start trading, he plans to buy. "What's there to think about?" Norrie said. He doesn't consider himself a Musk fanboy, just a believer in the tech founder's vision of a multi-planetary future powered by superhuman artificial intelligence. "You have a limitless industry with Elon Musk at the helm," Norrie said. On Friday, the SpaceX stock ticker is expected to make its debut in the biggest initial public offering of all time. Musk plans to raise close to $75 billion in a deal that could make him the world's first trillionaire. The stock offering also will be a landmark moment for everyday investors in Wall Street's retail revolution. Over the past few years, individual investors have coalesced into a market-making moving force, upending hedge fund bets, salvaging struggling companies, and sending favored stocks straight to the moon. Total volume for both retail stock and options trades reached new records in May, according to Citadel Securities. Their power is expanding, and Musk knows as well as anyone how to tap it. At Tesla, individual investors make up about a third of the shareholder base. Their faith and enthusiasm helped the company's valuation reach a level that surpasses the next 30 largest automakers combined, despite ranking 12th in U.S. sales. Musk has promised to return the favor. "I'm a huge fan of small retail investors," he wrote in a 2020 tweet about a potential public offering of SpaceX or its Starlink businesses. "We'll make sure they get top priority. You can hold me to it." Musk is expected to set aside an unusually large portion of SpaceX shares sold in the offering for individual investors, likely around 20% or more, compared with 5% to 7% of shares typically allocated in an IPO. Even that sizable chunk will likely fall short of demand. The company, valued at about $1.77 trillion at its $135 targeted IPO price, has been effectively inaccessible to most retail investors. Brokerages that cater to those traders anticipate an overwhelming number of takers. Financial firms are responding with similar enthusiasm. A Merrill Lynch office in Houston held an information meeting about the SpaceX IPO for clients last week. People familiar with the matter said, guests received baseball hats adorned with SpaceX logo. Individual traders are expected to play a crucial, though risky, role in powering a double-digit jump on listing day. Some stocks have debuted to great fanfare, then tumbled in the weeks after going public. About a quarter of IPO stocks lose at least half of their value in the 3 years after listing day, according to historical data collected by University of Florida Professor Emeritus J. Ritter. Through more than two decades as a private company, SpaceX has raised billions of dollars from shareholders that include many of the world's largest money managers. From mutual funds to big endowments, the skeptics, including some retail traders, say the easy money has already been made and that the pros are looking for someone else to get stuck holding the bag. SpaceX's valuation grew more than 2,000% in the past few years. Individual investors missed out on nearly all those gains, and they would have the most to lose if share prices fall. "I think most retail investors should avoid trading this like the plague," said Dave Nadig, a veteran fund analyst who expects extreme volatility in SpaceX share prices in the weeks after it goes public. "This is one of the biggest get-the-popcorn moments I've had." SpaceX didn't respond to requests for comment. The last time Tamer June tried to get in early on an IPO was Yahoo in 1996. June, now 63, said her home office at the time had a dial-up modem, trading software downloaded from a compact disc and a dodgy internet connection. "So painful," said June, a tech executive based in Reno, Nevada. On the day Yahoo went public, she placed an order for 100 shares when the market opened and sold them an hour later for a 30% profit, minus a hefty commission fee. In 2013, Robinhood Markets launched an app for commission-free trading, making it cheap and easy for rookie investors to trade stocks. For the first time, it was possible to dabble in all kinds of investments, from meme coins to complex options, on a smartphone. During the pandemic, Robinhood and other digital investment tools helped birth a new generation of day traders, drawing from people stuck at home, some flush with cash from government stimulus payments. Together, these investors sparked the meme stock frenzy that sent shares of video game retailer GameStop skyrocketing, and that caught Musk's attention. June, whose portfolio leans heavily towards tech giants such as Apple, Oracle, and Intel, is one of those vying for SpaceX shares. She said she has kept track of SpaceX for years and at home uses Starlink, the company's satellite internet service. There also is the allure of Musk himself. I get it. The guy is a bit strange, June said, but I think of the ideas he has executed. In the past 5 years, the retail crowd has burrowed into nearly every corner of Wall Street, piling into the artificial intelligence trade, placing wagers on prediction markets, and live tweeting company earnings calls. IPOs, once an exclusive domain, are no exception. Robinhood CEO Vlad Tenev said the brokerage in years past had to plead with issuers to set aside stock for the company's IPO access program, which distributes allocated retail shares at random to interested customers. Companies now ask Robinhood how much they should set aside for retail investors, Tenev told analysts on a call this spring. We really had to claw and scratch and ask for favors, Tenev said. Now, he added, pretty much every major IPO of consequence has been on Robinhood's platform. Like other brokerages, Robinhood offers investors the chance to request shares of specific IPOs at the listing price before the company goes public. There are no guarantees that customers get all the shares they want or any at all. Brokerages offering access to IPOs say it isn't unusual for requests to reach 10, 20, or 50 times the number of available shares. Most expect demand for SpaceX to be even greater. It's just the perfect storm for exorbitant retail enthusiasm and demand, said Mike Treacy, head market analyst and vice president of risk at Apex FinTech Solutions. Strap on your seatbelts. After the SpaceX prospectus was made public on May 20th, visitors to a Charles Schwab webpage of upcoming IPOs tripled, the brokerage said. Most of the interest is emotional, which is the honest truth, said Jeff Judge, a financial planner in Forest Hill, Maryland. People want to own a piece of Elon Musk's rocket company. Musk tapped his fan base to win a 2024 dispute over his $46 billion compensation package at Tesla. He campaigned on X to get the pay plan approved, and the company raffled off a chance for a tour of a Tesla production plant with the CEO. Musk is a superstar whether you like him or not, said Randall Brown, a 70-year-old retired physician and business owner hoping to buy SpaceX shares. Everything he touches, it works. That is the kind of faith Musk needs for an enterprise with a financial picture notably worse than any other mega-cap U.S. company. SpaceX was unprofitable last year, filing show, and losses widened in the first quarter of 2026. The company made $18.7 billion in revenue in 2025, meaning the company is priced at about 96.3 times its sales. By comparison, the price-to-sales ratio of the S&P 500 is roughly 3.3, according to FactSet. Individual investors, unlike the pros, are less likely to scrutinize a price-to-earnings ratio, much less a sophisticated cash flow analysis before clicking buy, according to Wall Street veterans. Musk's fans are stirred more by the entrepreneur's long-term vision of rockets, robots, AI chatbots, and data centers in space. Small-time investors without a six-figure portfolio are welcome. Robinhood doesn't have a minimum balance requirement to request shares of SpaceX. Fidelity generally requires a minimum of $100,000 or $500,000 in brokerage accounts for investors to engage in IPOs, depending on the offering. For SpaceX, the threshold at Fidelity was set at $2,000. Critics on Wall Street say the risks of holding SpaceX shares extend to millions of rank-and-file savers. Months ahead of the offering, bankers reached out to major index providers to discuss how SpaceX might join key indexes sooner than usual. That means SpaceX shares would show up almost immediately in some of the index funds that anchor stock portfolios nationwide. The NASDAQ, the exchange where SpaceX chose to list, agrees to fast-track entry into its NASDAQ 100. Shares of SpaceX would be eligible to join the index after just 15 trading days, instead of waiting as long as a year. The S&P 500 on Thursday denied Musk a speedy entry, saying it would uphold its timeframes and rules requiring that entrants first be profitable. SpaceX lost $4.9 billion last year. SpaceX has instituted staggered lockup releases for its stock, meaning there will be more shares available sooner than usual for newly public companies, and that could drive the stock price lower. A top-heavy market could amplify swings in tech shares. A frenetic rally in semiconductor stocks abruptly reversed last week, sending the NASDAQ composite down 4.2% in its worst day in more than a year. Banks are telling prospective investors that SpaceX revenue could reach $3.4 trillion in 2040, according to a Morgan Stanley analysis, The Wall Street Journal reported. On the day of the SpaceX IPO, Josh Hill, a 37-year-old North Carolina-based sales manager at a manufacturing company, plans to pour a cup of coffee, close the door to his home office, open Robinhood, and wait for SpaceX shares to start trading. Hill expects Musk to dominate the space industry long term, he said. It's a no-brainer. But will he hit buy on Friday? The price would have to fall, Hill said. Otherwise, I'm probably not a buyer. Write to Hannah Aaron Lang at Hannah Herrin, that's HannahHerrin.lang at WSJ.com, and Corey Drybush at Corey, Corrie, dot Drybush at WSJ.com. Corey Drybush writes about the most buzzed about initial public offerings and secretive private companies for the Wall Street Journal. Hannah Aaron Lang is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in New York, where she covers financial markets with a focus on retail investing and brokerages. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones, and you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Los Angeles stadium workers reach deal to head off World Cup strike. Union says lowest paid workers at SoFi Stadium will get big pay raise, by Paul Kiernan. Los Angeles. Around 2,000 hospitality workers at Los Angeles SoFi Stadium have reached a deal that will likely avert a strike during the World Cup, their union said Tuesday. The pact will increase hourly wages for the lowest paid workers to $40 from less than $28, as demanded, according to Kurt Peterson, co-president of Unite Here Local 11. The deal also gives the union the right to strike even after signing a collective bargaining agreement if workers feel threatened by the presence of federal immigration agents during the World Cup. We won every major issue that we brought to the table, Peterson said during a union press conference at the stadium. Legends Global, the concessions operator at SoFi Stadium, confirmed it had reached an agreement with Local 11. The company said it looks forward to delivering an outstanding hospitality experience during World Cup matches. Two mega events, the World Cup and the 2028 Summer Olympics, are giving unions in Los Angeles leverage to try to negotiate lucrative deals for workers. Last year, the City Council passed a union-backed ordinance that would have lifted the minimum wage for hotel workers to $30 an hour by 2028, though the increase has since been delayed. The stadium workers' new contract, if signed, is set to expire in April 2028, teeing up another potential fight before the Summer Olympics begin in Los Angeles. Contracts for Local 11 represented hotel and airport workers are also set to expire in 2028. The SoFi Stadium strike threat and deal are the latest instance of a major union flexing its muscles to exact concessions and wage demands. This union is one of the most powerful in the hospitality industry and represents more than 32,000 workers in California and Arizona. Local 11 SoFi Stadium workers overwhelmingly voted late last week to authorize a strike, which means a work stoppage could have started any time. Union officials made it clear that the U.S. national team's opening World Cup match against Paraguay would be an opportune moment. Workers represented by the union include cashiers, dishwashers, cooks, bartenders, and concession workers. Union members are planning to vote Wednesday on whether to ratify the contract. Other provisions of the agreement include a significant ongoing contribution to build housing for hospitality workers, protections against automation and subcontracting, and premium pay for the World Cup and 2027 Super Bowl, Peterson said. Stadium bartender Eva Miles is already looking ahead to the expected 2028 negotiations. "See you in 2 years," she said, "because we get it coming again." Appeared in the June 10, 2026 print edition as LA Stadium averts World Cup strike. Paul Kiernan is an economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Los Angeles. Beijing's industrial policy of everything leaves the rest of the world in the dust. Government support encompasses the old, the new, goods and services, micro and macro. Nothing Trump elicits in China will change this. By Greg Ip. In the decades since China joined the world economy, U.S. presidents have traveled to Beijing with a predictable list of demands. Stop stealing American intellectual property. Don't force technology transfer. Open your markets. Donald Trump followed the script on his previous visit in 2017. Whether he does so again this week, it will be pointless. Those demands reflect a view of Chinese industrial policy, broadly government support for favored sectors, that is woefully out of date. Xi Jinping has elevated Chinese industrial policy into something the world has never seen. It targets almost every industry and region, demand as well as supply, services as well as goods, the sophisticated and the mundane. Its goals are economic, technological, and strategic. Its tools are microeconomic and macroeconomic. There is no obvious solution. Trump has reportedly secured agreements by China to purchase soybeans, energy, and aircraft, withhold military equipment from Iran, and open up more to American businesses. But none of this will stop China from swallowing ever more global market share. Rhodium Corp Group, a research organization, in a sobering new report prepared on behalf of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and released this week, identifies the key features of what it calls China's industrial policy of everything. Many Chinese products now match or beat Western competitors on quality and price without government help. Yet, rather than dial back support, Beijing keeps broadening it. The country's five-year plan issued in 2021 listed 19 priority sectors. The latest, released in March, lists 24, adding brain-computer interfaces and nuclear fusion energy. While sexy products such as smartphones and electric vehicles hog the limelight, China's ambitions also cover the mature and the mundane. The Made in China 2025 plan, released in 2015 that caused so much consternation in the West, earmarked 10 industries for self-sufficiency. The update issued in 2023 dropped one and added seven, including mature industries such as household appliances and textiles. Chemicals are a good example. Global exports of tetrachlorethylene used in dry cleaning have risen 25-fold since 2019. Exports of oxyalene used in plastics and coatings have climbed 12-fold. Chemicals also illustrate the emptiness of China's promises to cut back on overcapacity, dubbed involution, which has depressed prices and profits. Rhodium reports that 2025 directive promised to address petrochemical overcapacity, but only plants more than 20 years sold were targeted, accounting for 5% to 6% of capacity. Far from shrinking output, the plan aimed to shift the industry from bulk to high-value chemicals and boost output 5% a year. Rhodium reports that once Chinese firms reach technological parity with their competitors, they take market share at breathtaking speed. The result, in 2016, Rhodium estimates China controlled more than 50% of export volumes in 163 industries, out of about 2,000 for which data is available. By 2024, that had risen to 315. China's massive trade surpluses are often attributed to chronically weak domestic demand. Yet China can create demand when it wants. To nurture its drone industry, Beijing encourages numerous sectors, including agriculture, local government, and tourism, to integrate drones. Complemented by public investment in enabling infrastructure, including the use of local government special bonds, Rhodium writes. Xi once regarded services as inferior to the real economy. Not anymore. A series of state directives since 2024 have singled out high-value services such as biopharma contracting, which conducts testing, research and development, and manufacturing for multinational drug companies. It saw sales double between 2018 and 2022, and they are projected to double again by 2027, Rhodium concludes. Choke points targeted. National security is integral to Xi's industrial policy. Eliminating imports makes China less vulnerable to foreign pressure, while increasing export market share makes others more vulnerable to Chinese pressure. Thus, Xi prioritizes choke point products that are critical to larger supply chains, such as organic chemicals and machinery, Rhodium reports. China routinely retaliates against unfriendly governments by weaponizing its market, that is, shutting out their exports. Weaponizing choke points is more potent, with the potential to shut down entire production lines. Even the U.S., the only economy large enough to resist Chinese pressure, sought a trade war truce when China imposed export controls on rare earths and critical minerals. As dependence on China increases, the capacity of foreign governments to mitigate that dependence diminishes, Rhodium warns. The pervasive nature of China's industrial policy makes it difficult for competitors to counter. Trump's tariffs, for example, have driven down the U.S. trade deficit with China, but China has redirected exports to other markets. And because Chinese inputs are omnipresent in global supply chains, the value of Chinese content entering the U.S. can remain steady even as imports drop. This could be addressed through tariffs on Chinese content, regardless of where the product originated, or through tighter rules of origin, a particular thrust of Trump's trade negotiators. But that wouldn't solve the competitive threat. The U.S. could ban every Chinese-made product, but those products would keep gaining market share abroad, threatening American leadership. For example, Chinese electric vehicles may incorporate Chinese software and artificial intelligence. As those EVs gain market share abroad, Chinese software and AI may supplant U.S. rivals as the global standard. This calls for a joint response by all market-based democracies to Chinese industrial policy. But U.S. allies' willingness to coordinate with the U.S. on China, never high to start with, has eroded further under Trump. The Achilles heel of Chinese industrial policy is its cost and waste. China runs bigger budget deficits relative to economic output than the U.S. Outside advanced manufacturing, the economy is moribund, weighted down by debt, deflation, and aging demographics. Many critics thus expect, even hope, that Chinese industrial policy will eventually implode under the weight of its own contradictions. But there's no guarantee that that will happen soon. To paraphrase an adage about markets, China can stay irrational longer than foreign competitors can stay solvent. Greg Ipp is the Wall Street Journal's chief economics commentator. Diets high in ultra-processed foods are associated with dementia risk. Plus, new research on anesthesia and a brain tumor radiation device by Connor Grant. Eating a diet high in ultra-processed foods is associated with an increased risk of dementia, according to new research, adding to the growing list of health problems linked to foods such as packaged cookies, hot dogs, and chips. Though we often think of anesthesia as putting us in a deep sleep, new research suggests it could actually be closer to being in a coma than previously thought. And there's still lots we don't know about how these drugs work on the brain, even though thousands of patients undergo a general anesthetic every day. Radiation device placed in brain cuts tumor reoccurrence, boosts survival. A new study showed that gammatile, a radioactive wafer the size of a postage stamp, nearly doubled survival rates and nearly eliminated tumor regrowth in people who had it placed in the spot where brain tumors were surgically removed. In the news, the FDA launched a safety study of the abortion pill, also known as mifepristone, a step that could eventually lead the Trump administration to restrict how it's distributed and used. The autism therapy business is booming, and so is the billing abuse. A WSJ investigation found that predatory providers are billing for phantom services, padding their hours, and charging steep fees. Here, there are five takeaways from the report. A rare strain of Ebola has reached territory controlled by Islamic State militants in the Democratic Republic of Congo, a place too dangerous for health workers fighting to stop the deadly virus. A melanoma drug from Replimune Group got a third chance despite previous FDA rejections after the White House pushed health officials to re-examine the treatment. And here's an opinion piece from the editorial board. Trump's latest big tax increase. He slaps tariffs on some 60 countries with a forced labor excuse. By the editorial board. Courts keep knocking down President Trump's border taxes, but he keeps imposing them no matter the economic or soon the political harm. His tariff fixation is as unmovable as Bernie Sanders' loathing for the rich. The U.S. Trade Representative last week teed up new tariffs of 10% to 12.5% on some 60 countries after the Supreme Court struck down the president's emergency tariffs in February. The administration invoked Section 122 to impose a 10% across-the-board tariff. A federal court last month ruled those tariffs unlawful, and they are also time-limited to 150 days. So Mr. Trump is dusting off Section 301, which lets him impose tariffs in response to unfair foreign acts, policies, or practices affecting U.S. commerce. The first Trump administration used the law to slap tariffs on China as punishment for its mercantilist policies, including intellectual property theft and forced technology transfers. But rather than perform detailed investigations for each country, the Trade Office simply declares that they all engage in unfair trade practices by failing to impose and effectively enforce a forced labor import prohibition. This creates a dynamic where American workers are forced to compete globally on an unlevel playing field, says U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer. Sorry, forced labor isn't why companies manufacture products outside the U.S. Other countries have comparative advantages, but we know there's no point of informing the president about David Ricardo. Countries that ban imports using forced labor but fail to effectively enforce their prohibitions will get a 10% tariff. This includes six targets: Canada, Ecuador, the European Union, Indonesia, Mexico, and Pakistan. All other countries will endure a 12.5% tax. These rates seem as arbitrary as his emergency tariffs. Pakistan and Indonesia have been accused of tolerating forced and child labor, but they get a lower tariff rate than Switzerland, the UK, and Australia. Huh? These implausible targets suggest forced labor is a mere pretext to impose universal tariffs. The president campaigned on an across-the-board 10% tariff, and that's more or less what he seems to be settling on with Section 301. Assuming he doesn't ratchet up the rates on a whim, as he often does. The Tax Foundation estimated last year that a 10% universal tariff would raise a $1.7 trillion to $2.2 trillion over a decade. That's a big tax increase, and it comes on top of the president's Section 232 national security tariffs on wood products, copper, autos, and auto parts, steel, aluminum, and derivative metal products. Those tariffs raised $20 billion during the first 7 months of his fiscal year. Maybe the only salve is that U.S. trade representatives appears to be creating big holes in the tariff wall. But this also reveals the arbitrary nature of the border taxes. The Section 301 memo proposes exemptions for products subject to Section 232 tariffs. This includes raw materials that, if subject to the proposed additional tariffs, could lead to the unavailability of domestic supply, products that could cause economy-wide disruptions if they were tariffed, certain products that cannot be grown or produced in sufficient quantities in the United States or obtained from other sources, and articles for which additional tariffs may not contribute substantially to the elimination of the investigated acts, policies, and practices described above. The latter could include basically everything. There will also be a reduced rate for textiles. Lobbyists, on your marks, get set and go to Howard Lutnick at Commerce or the White House, and don't forget your campaign checkbook. Mr. Trump's tariff obsession is a self-defeating act. There's been no surge in domestic manufacturing, and they are contributing to rising prices. They are also unpopular, especially in the Farm Belt. That's presumably why he reduced the Section 232 tariff rate on farm equipment recently to 15% from 25%. Tariffs are a major reason voters aren't happy with Mr. Trump and Republicans on the economy and inflation. A recent Fox News poll showed that 71% of voters disapprove of his handling of the economy, including 42% of those who voted for the president and 67% of whites without college degrees. Good luck in November, Republicans. And here's a letter to the editor, the CDC's flawed logic on Ebola restrictions. The agency's recent actions are a departure from longstanding public health approaches. In The CDC is Protecting Americans from Ebola, op-ed, June 4th, Jay Bhattacharya, acting director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, argues that current CDC policies are scientifically justified and reflect lessons learned from mistakes made during the COVID-19 pandemic. We agree that public health leaders should learn from past mistakes. One COVID lesson is that effective risk communication requires humility, transparency, and a grounding in science rather than overstated certainty. Dr. Bhattacharya's op-ed falls short on all accounts. For decades, the CDC and global health partners have relied on risk-based approaches to Ebola and other emerging infectious diseases, recognizing that broad travel restrictions and movement controls can discourage reporting, drive cases underground, hinder response efforts, disrupt supply chains, and make outbreaks harder to contain. The Trump administration has adopted restrictions that depart from these longstanding principles without publicly presenting evidences to justify doing so. While Dr. Bhattacharya signed the initial Ebola travel restrictions, the subsequent expansion to include green card visa holders was signed by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. The administration has publicly given no scientific rationale explaining why citizenship or immigration status would alter risk of infection or transmission. Pathogens don't recognize passports. The administration's actions have also been inconsistent. Current CDC guidance recommends active monitoring of individuals with high-risk Ebola exposures. Yet, recent actions have included transporting Americans exposed to Ebola to other countries rather than repatriating them to the U.S. The justification of faster transport to treatment doesn't make sense given Ebola's incubation time of 2 to 21 days. Even if someone does become ill, it takes time for Ebola to progress from dry symptoms to highly contagious wet symptoms. Transparency, particularly the radical transparency that this administration has promised, requires a clear accounting of who made these decisions, what evidence was considered, and why longstanding public health approaches were changed. Deborah Howery, MD, MPH, and Krutika Kupali, MD, Atlanta and Dallas. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.